Hello, and welcome to the newest episode of the More Than Books podcast. As usual, I'm your host, Joel, and I'm joined by Colin once again.
Hello again.
Hello. And as promised, we're going to do part two of our Summer Reading Club podcast special. We've been discussing books and things we've read somewhat recently that we thought would be good kind of lighter reading for the most part. Colin had some...
I broke that rule, I think.
Pretty in-depth items on his list. But hey, that's okay. Everybody likes something different. And
everyone enjoys summer in their own way, right?
And that's kind of the point of summer reading, is we have a little more time, theoretically, to get some reading done. And yeah, so everybody kind of enjoys something different. So to start part two off, I'll start again. A book that I had wanted to talk about last time that I didn't quite get a chance to during our previous discussion was another somewhat horror-related, horror fantasy book called Bird Box by Josh Malerman. This actually came out a couple years ago. It won a couple awards. I think it won a Bram Stoker Award, and has recently been picked up by Netflix to be made into a feature-length movie, I think starring Sandra Bullock.
Oh.
Yeah. It's an interesting kind of post-apocalyptic horror story. So, for the most part, the book takes place after the end of the world has already happened. So, if you ever saw the movie, what is that? The one that came out, the horror movie that came out this summer, where everybody has to be quiet, A Quiet Place.
Quiet Place, yeah.
Yeah, that was a big hit, kind of a similar story, actually, I think, to this one, except in A Quiet Place, the actors, you know, are hiding out in a cabin. If they make noise, they're going to get attacked by the monsters because it's all based off sound. Bird Box, I mean, came out before A Quiet Place, but the plot is similar in that in this kind of post-apocalyptic world, everybody has to cover their eyes. If they look at the monster, if they see it, for some reason, it can sense them and attack them.
Huh.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if it's... It's very vague. I mean, obviously they get around, you know, what the monster looks like. They never really have to describe it. It's kind of right. This vague threat, and they just know that people that look on it or look at it end up dying. So it follows a young mother that's with her kids trying to survive and ends up holding up in this house with a few other survivors. The title is kind of based off a way that they sense if, you know, the monsters or creatures are lurking around outside is they have a box full of baby birds that they feed, and when the monsters kind of come near, they kind of start freaking out. So the bird box is kind of this alarm system that they have to let them know to make sure all the windows are closed, make sure the doors are closed, make sure no one opens the door.
Kind of like an inverse canary in the coal mine.
Exactly, and I think that's kind of the kind of a little theme in the book.
Sure.
So obviously with these kinds of stories, you know, the monster is the existential threat, but a lot of times other threats come from, you know, humanity as well. So
yes,
people in the house, something, you know, may not be right with all of them, or there may be, and not to give away spoilers, I'm just trying to give a general synopsis of the story, but you know, you kind of always got to be wary of the other survivors in these kinds of stories. So I think it's an interesting book, the way it deals with generally avoiding having to describe the monster. It's a lot more psychological in that you're getting the people's thoughts and feelings about the situation rather than, you know, this kind of pulpy schlock. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I feel like that's one thing that people don't give, like, horror stuff enough credit for is the fact that, of course, on the surface it is usually pulp, it is usually schlock, it's usually there for shock value, but a lot of the enduring, like, horror works, whether we're talking about, like, movies or books, usually have some kind of psychological perspective that's unique because of the way that the story is set up, the way that the monsters interact with the people. Or it's just kind of like commentary on humanity or human society, or, I mean,
I mean, a lot of the best horror is basically boiled down to a commentary on
the
real monster is people.
Yeah. Or in the case of Dawn of the Dead, the real monster is shopping malls.
Consumerism. That's always been a fun kind of motif in modern horror, probably classic horror as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Just
going back to Frankenstein, yeah.
Yeah, it gets at those kind of core fears and those core worries about life and, you know, builds on them. So I think the book was a quick read. It was the writing itself, very competent. You know, sometimes you find a new author and, you know, it may be kind of a fun story, but it may not be executed in the best manner.
Yeah.
But I do think that this book in particular was a pretty competent, very well written for, you know, kind of a... Like I said, I found it really weird that, like, when A Quiet Place came out, the first thing I thought of was, oh, that's kind of like Bird Box. Mm. Slightly different, just those kind of high concept...
Sure. It's funny because I looked at your list before we recorded. I was just kind of looking things up so I could... hopefully contribute something to the conversation. And it seems like this author had actually written this book quite a while ago and then was afraid of publishing it because at the time a lot of other post-apocalyptic things were coming out. Like, I think the big one at the time was Cormac McCarthy's The Road, which is a pretty fantastic book.
I mean, that's an amazing book.
Yeah, it is. So he just kind of kept holding on to it and holding on to it and holding on to it.
And I could see some of the similarities, but... I mean, The Road is clearly, I mean, a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. I mean, it's amazingly well-written. The thing reads like a poem at times.
Right.
But this book is not on that level. When I say it's well-written, I don't mean it's...
Sure. No, it's pulpier than that. Yeah. It sounds like it's still good. It sounds like it still tackles some weightier themes.
Yeah.
No,
it's a good book. And it kind of pairs well because he just actually released a new book, the same author, Josh Malerman, released a new book earlier this summer. So I know, you know, it's the Summer Reading Club, so I thought I'd mention it. The new book is called Unbury Carol, and it sounds like another high concept kind of fantasy horror vibe, probably leaning more towards fantasy. Actually, I heard it described as kind of a Western as well, but the general plot, apparently, it's about a woman who lapses into long comas, and her husband plans on declaring her dead so he doesn't have to deal with it anymore, like when she goes into a coma, and he buries her alive. I haven't read this book. I just know that it recently came out and got some pretty good reviews so far.
Okay.
And I guess it's supposed to be, like, the author was kind of inspired by Sleeping Beauty as kind of a fable, but wanted to turn it around on its head a little bit as, you know, a lot of modern, you know, storytelling is taking old ideas and making them fresh again. So he sets it in the Wild West. He makes her have this illness or this situation, and she wakes up buried alive and has to figure out what to do. So that's Unbury Carol. So what do you have?
Well, the first book I'm going to talk about is actually one that we've talked about briefly before. We talked about it during our copyright discussion podcast.
Okay.
When we were talking about public domain and how long it takes for works to enter the public domain and that sort of thing. And I brought up a book during that podcast called the A Humument. And I forgot the author's name and all that kind of stuff while we were talking about it. But I figured I'd give that book its due and talk about it a little bit here, because it's really an interesting book. So yeah, it's called The Human Mint. It's by an author, or really an artist, named Tom Phillips. He began work on this book in the late 60s, 1966. The first edition of it was like published in 72, and then it's gone through several radical revisions since then, with the most recent one being published in 2016.
I think I remember, I remember that conversation because it's that book that he basically took an old novel and reworked it, but almost to a ridiculous point where it's completely chopped up and made something completely new.
Exactly. So he took this novel called A Human Document. It's like a Victorian era novel. And he just kind of slowly painted over all the pages, leaving only certain words visible.
Okay.
With the end result being that it kind of winds up being this kind of like stream of consciousness poem slash narrative that's kind of told in a nonlinear structure. Like, it's pretty experimental stuff, kind of James Joycean in that way. But part of the appeal of the book is not so much the text itself, which, well, good, you know, you're kind of stuck with what you've got in the base book itself.
Yeah.
I think the main appeal is the illustrations.
Yeah, it's very visual. Colin just passed me the final edition of it.
Right.
And every single page is a unique piece of art, it looks like.
Yep.
With just painted over the page in the book with the words kind of highlighted, or some of the words highlighted to make a new sentence or a new story.
And they look kind of like speech bubbles from comics.
Yeah,
It's really interesting. So this book, this original book, was like a Victorian era book. Apparently it was pretty racist, kind of garbage, not very good. But Tom Phillips became kind of deeply attached to it, and he's used it in a lot of other things. So he's done illustrations for other books, like he did illustrations for a set of Cicero's writings, and he did illustrations for, I think, Paradise Lost. But in those, he was still using pages from this book, and he would just paint new paintings over them for the illustrations of these other books. So he's reused it and recycled it a lot in his other work throughout the years. And it's... the book itself is kind of a cool book. It's pretty small, but it kind of reminds me of those like medieval illuminated manuscripts where every page is just super intricate, but the book itself is really tiny and kind of unassuming.
Okay.
And it tells an interesting kind of poem story, but it's
like, does it make sense?
It does make sense. It is a little nonlinear. It is a little abstract, but you can read through it in one sitting and kind of get the gist of what's going on. There's characters, they have motivations, they have relationships with one another, that sort of thing. It is, like I said, a little Joycean in his most kind of like abstract way. Maybe not quite as intense as that, but not completely dissimilar. But the fact that he took this old text and then he's also managing to work in like modern references like 9/11 and Facebook and that sort of thing into it, which of course is new to this edition, because when he published the original edition of it back in the 70s, 9/11 and Facebook
hadn't happened.
So each book is kind of each version of it's kind of a radical revision of the previous edition, where he's changed the artwork, he's changed the text. It's been kind of a highly evolving work.
And it does sound like this is the final completed edition. Like,
that's what he's saying. I mean, he's getting on in years. Maybe that's part of it. Maybe there's just other things he wants to spend his life on, given that he's given so many years to this project.
Has he written anything else?
Not to my knowledge. He is a fairly notable visual artist. He's done some like album artwork and stuff. Like the two that I can think of that he's done, where he did he did Brian Eno's Another Green World. He did the cover art for that. And then one of King Crimson's albums, Starless and Bible Black. So he's been around for a while doing a lot of things. But I think he's primarily known as an illustrator. And to be fair, I mean, it's hard to say to what extent he like wrote this book. Because everything was already in there written for him. He just kind of edited it heavily and created something new out of it.
And it's hard to tell over a podcast.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's a very visual book.
I recommend Googling and doing a Google image search for some of for the author and the book title, and just taking a look at some of the pages in there, because it is impressive. Every single page is a unique piece of art.
Some of the pages will look great just hanging on a wall, honestly.
Yeah, definitely.
This is like little kind of like miniature illustrated poems. So, it's a highly recommended book. I'd love to go back and look at some of the older editions of it and see how it compares and how it's changed over the years. But I really like kind of sort of like living works like that, things that feel like they're never really done.
I mean, it's very non-traditional. When I first looked at the book, I immediately thought of like House of Leaves, which is an actual story, but yes. Like
it's kind of like two stories.
Yeah, kind of has a few traditional stories inside, but it's mm-hmm. the presentation that's very non-traditional with
it's got lots of like loops and buried narratives in it, where a lot of the story is told through like footnotes
inside of footnotes at times, and
yeah, it's like I would describe it as like recursive fiction. So you're like reading the top layer, and then you have to go down to a footnote, and then you're at some kind of second layer, and then that footnote might have a footnote or refer you elsewhere in the book entirely. So you're not really reading it in a linear way. You're kind of flipping back and forth. If you're not careful, you can get stuck in an infinite loop. And stuff like that.
Yeah,
it's a good book.
And as you get into it too, like some of the pages start to like are like flipped or you know upside down or
yeah. There's a lot of typographical play with it.
There's definitely like the book would really only work in a printed form.
Yeah, although apparently he wrote a TV pilot for it.
Yeah.
I guess since we're talking about this book slightly, anyways. And I think we would probably both recommend that book, even though neither of us have read it recently.
Yeah.
The name of that author is Daniel Efsky. I can't think of his first name, unfortunately.
Mark, or did I make that up?
It might be Mark. It might be Mark Daniel Efsky.
Yeah.
His last name is very long and difficult to spell, so I'm not going to try it.
Yeah, he wrote House of Leaves, which came out mm-hmm. in 2000, and that's the book we're talking about.
Yeah.
And he has a couple other books that he's written since then.
And I think they're pretty enjoyable, too. Maybe House of Leaves is his most straightforward, which is kind of weird to say. Yeah, Only Revolutions, and his newest one is like a series that he's
writing. Familiar.
The Familiar.
Yeah, I think Volume 5 came out in 2017.
I've gotten as far as Volume 2. I've got a little bit of catching up to do on that one. But if you're looking for more abstract, arty books to pick up that are really weird to look at. They're not laid out like traditional books. He might be an easier entry point potentially than something like a Humament. But if you're just looking for like really cool kind of collaged art and painting, Humament is where I would turn. So
nice. Yeah, that sounds very cool. I might have to actually get a copy and read through and try to decipher it and make sense of it.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those books that you can do that sort of thing with. And this edition has a very generous afterword where he talks about his process and all that kind of thing.
Sometimes that stuff is almost as interesting as the work itself.
Exactly, yeah. when an artist becomes that deeply invested in something that they really have to set aside the time to explain themselves and their work. Yeah, no, it's good. So that's my recommendation. Light Summer, I mean, you can finish it in a day. I don't know if it's light, but, you know, it's something you can sit down in a couple hours, kind of like a comic book, and get through it all the way, so.
All right. Well, I guess it's my turn again. So my next recommendation is another somewhat horror-themed, which that's, I know, I've been reading a lot of that stuff lately, but it's light. It can be fun. This one's not too, it's a dark book, but it's not quite as dark as, like, the Bird Box, which is post-apocalyptic dark. this is Lovecraft Country by Matt Ruff.
Okay.
Which... it's a really interesting take on not directly the H.P. Lovecraft mythos, but kind of indirectly. But H.P. Lovecraft is pretty well known as being kind of a very racist person in his works and mm-hmm. in his life. And that's something that sometimes comes out in his works.
And that's something that the horror community has struggled with a lot because his works had such a seminal impact on horror literature as well. So
yeah, definitely. Like, it's one of the earliest, like, most successful American horror authors. Mm-hmm. What he was mainly writing in the 1920s and 30s.
Yep.
So
he kind of came up at around the same time that the guy who wrote Conan did. I can't remember his name. They were writing like kind of pulp stuff, but in retrospect, Lovecraft's work has been assigned a lot more kind of like literary quality. Than a lot of the other pulp stuff that was being written at the same time. That...
It's definitely written in kind of a heightened language. It's not... it has pulpy themes, mm-hmm. but maybe that we only think of them as pulpy themes now.
it reminds me... maybe this is an inaccurate comparison, but in my mind, I always lump Edgar Allan Poe and Lovecraft together, just in terms of maybe their writing style and basic themes. Lovecraft takes things in a much... a further extreme direction than I think Poe ever did. Poe was mostly interested in kind of like psychological stuff, just humans yeah. being awful to one another, whereas Lovecraft is about monsters.
So. Yeah, yeah. Monsters and the fear of the other, which mm-hmm. is a big theme in his works. A lot of times there'll be like a cult worshipping some strange, mystical, mm-hmm. cosmic, it has to be cosmic, yep. Entity, and a lot of times those cults will be made up of, you know, scary foreigners, which is yes. where a lot of the racism comes from.
Yeah, it is unfortunate.
Yeah. But the author, Matt Ruff, I think seemed a little fascinated by that concept, and he wanted to make a book that kind of paid homage to like the good things about H.P. Lovecraft's work mm-hmm. while also highlighting the bad things. So Lovecraft Country is a story that's mainly from the point of view of a group of African-American characters going on a road trip through the Jim Crow South and the strange situations that they encounter along the way. It's really more a loosely organized collection of short stories than a single narrative. I mean, different characters come in and out for different plot points, but yeah, it's kind of focused. I think the road trip originally starts with the main character trying to find his dad and, you know, having to drive across the country. And they use this this book as kind of a guidebook, which I found kind of fascinating. It was a guidebook that was published by African-Americans for African-Americans that were needing to travel. And it basically had a list of safe places you could stop overnight. It had a list of, like, if your car breaks down, you can call this mechanic and they'll actually help you.
Wow.
Restaurants that you can go in and actually be served, that kind of thing. Like, so, and I found that aspect of it really fascinating and illuminating. And, you know, when the monsters show up, you know, sometimes they're running into just regular racist people.
Right.
And those are the monsters. And sometimes there's something more going on. One of the kind of stories involves getting invited to stay at this old, like, manor house, and the owners of the house, you know, obviously there's, like, something going on. It's not sure. quite sure, and it turns out to be, like, a cult and, you know, sacrifice and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
Very pulpy, very H.P. Lovecraft-inspired, some of the stories. What I find interesting about this, other than, you know, that kind of innovative take on the genre, is that it's... It actually just got is getting the adaptation treatment as well. HBO picked up the rights to make a series off of it, and Jordan Peele, one of the Key and Peele comic duo guys, he was also the writer director of the great movie Get Out that mm-hmm. came out last year. He's the one that's going to be producing or show running.
Oh, that's great!
The show for HBO. And it looks like J.J. Abrams is also signed on as a producer. So, yeah, that's going to be coming to HBO, I think, next year, the year after.
Okay.
It's in early to mid-production. I think there's been some casting details already announced nice. For it. But yeah, yeah, it's an interesting book. I don't think it's a solid narrative. Like, I was a little disappointed by the narrative structure, but as mm-hmm. a TV show, I could see, like, something episodic or... almost more of a collection of somewhat related but unrelated stories. I could see that being an interesting take on a TV show.
No, yeah, that sounds ideal for TV format. And it sounds like it's an interesting book, too. That might be right up my alley, actually. I'll have to check that one out.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Your turn again.
My turn again. So last time I talked about a book called The Peregrine by J.A. Baker. This next book I'm going to talk about, I read right before that book, and it was kind of a coincidence that it happened this way, because they are both books about nature, they're both really short, they both have wonderful prose, they're both kind of like insular and a little weird, but whereas that book is really kind of dark and freaky and apocalyptic and violent, this book was kind of the opposite. It was like light and sensual and pretty and just an extremely enjoyable read, and this book is called The Living Mountain. It's by Nan Shepherd. Shepherd was a Scottish novelist and poet who passed away in 1981. She wrote this book during the 1940s, but chose not to publish it She was afraid that it would not be well received or even well understood. I think she did try to get it published once, but it was rejected. Her story is that she was kind of like an avid hill walker. She really loved and was maybe kind of obsessed by the Cairngorm Mountains in Scotland. They are in the eastern Scottish Highlands. Google pictures of them. They're really quite spectacular. They feature like high altitude lakes and streams, and they're partially surrounded by some of Scotland's like last remaining ancient forests. They're also pretty brutal. The lowest recorded temperatures and highest recorded wind speeds in the UK were both recorded in this mountain range. So yeah, this book is just kind of her, I don't want to say diary because it's not a diary, but it's like a recording of her recollections of kind of spending a lifetime exploring these mountains. She, you know, talks about the landscape, the weather, the flora, the fauna, and she kind of like uses all of these physical aspects of the mountain as a way to talk about like obsession and loneliness and fear, and just really like sharp, kind of like poetic prose. She's extremely highly regarded in Scotland, but I don't think much known elsewhere. She is even, as of a couple of years ago, her face is on the Scottish £5 notes.
Oh, nice.
And there's a quote from this book on those notes as well. So if you're ever in Scotland, take a look at the £5 note. That's a good quote, too. It just got a new edition not too long ago, I think probably kind of concurrent with the time that her face was chosen to be put on the currency. And it's kind of hard to say a lot about it, because it is. It's such a short book. It's not even over 150 pages. It's another one of those books that you can read in a day, but it strikes me as being one of those books that you could return to year after year after year and keep finding new things to appreciate about it. It is prose, but I think it would appeal a lot to people who like to read poetry as well. So
I am kind of fascinated by these, like, these kind of nature explorations that are more, it's like, yeah, that's what the book is about, but they're not right. Actually about that. It's about, like, the emotions and feelings of, you know, being somewhere or...
Exactly. Yeah. And at the surface level, that's what makes both of these books, this and the Peregrine that I talked about last time, so fascinating, is they kind of trick you into thinking that it's going to be like this educational book, you know, about, you know, birds or this landscape or whatever the case may be. But it just kind of spirals into this really fascinating rabbit hole.
Nice.
That's about all of the above, so...
I kind of wish I had known about that last year, because I went to Scotland on my honeymoon, and I was by the Cairngorms National Park. We didn't go to it. We went to Inverness and then went up north to the Isle of Skye. And
sure.
Yeah. So that's kind of the area we went, which we were near it. I think the train we took up from Edinburgh probably went right by the national park when we were heading to Inverness.
Probably looked out a window and saw him.
Yeah, and I may not have even realized. But yeah, that's definitely something I might have checked out before that trip, just to get a little more context and a little more geographic information.
Yeah, well, and I think the mountains themselves have become a lot more accessible since her time as well.
Yeah.
I think later in life she was kind of lamenting the fact that there had been like rail lines established for people to go up and down the mountains and that sort of thing. I mean, they are dangerous mountains, to be fair. People have died on them, but it does mean that they've kind of become not necessarily commercialized in a way, but more readily accessible. And I think that was part of the fascination she had with them in the first place when writing this book, because she liked going up there and being alone, or being alone with someone else who also wanted to go up there and be alone. So. But yeah, if nothing else, go and Google images of them. They're really something else.
All right. In keeping with our kind of theme from last time, I talked about two kind of horror, or well, I guess I only talked about one horror item, one kind of pulpy fun book, and then a comic book.
Hmm.
I'm going to be talking about a comic book again.
Excellent.
Except this time, this comic book, it's Saga by Brian K. Vaughan.
Yeah.
And
this is one that both of us have actually read.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't finished the series yet. I'm still working my way through it, but I just found it really fun. I found the art style really really interesting. And so Brian K. Vaughan wrote a comic called Why the Last Man, which I was not in love with. I did read that whole series just...
It was a big deal at the time that it was coming out. It was attracting a lot of, like, non-comic book readers.
Yeah. For a non-superhero kind of comic story, mm-hmm. I mean, I felt like he was almost trying too hard some of the time.
In spots.
Yeah. Like, okay, yeah, that story is kind of about, like, basically there one man survives this apocalypse of some sort, or he's the only man left alive, and he's working, like, traveling through this world full of women and
right.
all the misadventures that befall him with his monkey sidekick.
Yeah.
That was one of the areas that I'm like,
That and the fact that his name was Yorick.
Yeah.
Just a few things that were just a little too cutesy about it like that.
Yeah. But he was a very, like, non-exceptional guy, which I mm-hmm. kind of appreciate. Like,
yeah.
just this normal guy, like, nothing really special about him, just kind of a nerdy character.
Kind of laid back, maybe like kind of a semi-deadbeat a little bit.
Yeah. And just the adventures that befall him on this trip.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting concept. I didn't hate it, but I wasn't in love with it. But it was pretty well regarded when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
So Saga, I've actually really liked, even though some of those little cutesy things do pop up in it, that's still... It doesn't really take me out of it quite as much in Saga as it did in Why the Last Man, so that's what's good about it.
Mm-hmm.
So Saga is, I guess the best way to describe it is a space opera
mm-hmm.
Style story about two warring races of people, or two warring planets, and one group has wings and the other group has horns, and they hate each other for basically unnamed reasons. They've just always been at war with one another. So a woman from the planet with wings falls in love with a man from the planet with horns, and they run away together and have a baby, and suddenly there's bounty hunters chasing after them. Both of the planets, like, think they're traitors, think they're... mm-hmm. If the word gets out about the fact that they fell in love and they're happy and have a child, then it'll cause their entire societies to collapse, or cause people to question everything that right. they've ever been taught in their society. So there's this whole, like, race to try to capture them or kill them or find them and make sure that no one finds out about their baby.
Who has both horns and wings, if I'm remembering correctly. Yeah.
Yeah, and so it's kind of about the misadventures that befall them as well. So it's fun in that the characters are kind of funny and interesting, but also they make a point of giving character to the bounty hunters that are chasing mm-hmm. after them, and people start developing their own stories and their own motivations.
Yeah, it's I'm sure there's a word for this type of storytelling, but it's kind of like, you know, dropping a pebble into a pond and the ripples are spreading out. That's very much what's happening with the series as well. The pebble was these two characters and their daughter who's born, and then it just kind of wraps up all these other characters in their narrative.
Yeah, and there is a lot of weird stuff in it.
It's gonzo to the extreme.
Yeah.
Like, it's just nonstop weirdness.
But that's what I like about comics.
Yeah, that they can do that.
Yeah, you can turn a page and be like, all right, this is a tree that's a rocket ship for some reason.
This is something that I've literally never seen before in anything else. And it's just, I wouldn't say page after page of that, but certainly every few pages you do get something pretty insane and wonderful and weird. So.
Yeah. And it works pretty well. It's really pretty.
It's super fast-paced.
Yeah, it is very fast-paced. Each issue, like, I've been reading probably two or three issues a night when mm-hmm. I have been reading it. I haven't read it for a couple weeks now, but, you can sit down and read a whole issue in 15 minutes, probably.
Yeah. Part of me wishes it weren't that fast-paced, because I just wants to spend a little more time in certain situations, but it just hurtles along at such a breakneck speed, and it is very much... like the misadventures of, like, they're just kind of stumbling from one bad situation into another, into another, into another. It's kind of exhausting.
But yeah, madcap. It's fun. Highly recommended. So that's a Saga by Brian K. Vaughan.
Yeah. Do you know who the illustrator is?
That's
I want to say it's Fiona something, but I could be wrong. Maybe she was the one that did Why the Last Man, and I'm getting them confused.
Mm-hmm. It was Fiona Staples as the illustrator for Saga, probably also the illustrator for Why the Last Man.
Maybe, yeah. Why the Last Man had great art in it as well, whether or not it was the same illustrator. If you like good comic art, either of these are good ones to pick up. So,
and that's the most fun thing about comic books to me, too, is just seeing these new worlds or seeing these new situations just visualized on pages, and these great, like, every single page can be a different, really cool image.
Yep. And the episodic format of this particular story just lends itself so, like, beautifully to that. Even the most episodic comics, I feel, kind of like fall into a rut or they begin to develop patterns. This just is insane. It's all over the place with all these different situations. It's great.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it looks like they're up to issue 54 already at this point. It's been published since, let's see, 2012 to present.
So. Yeah, and it is ongoing. That is an important thing to note. So if you don't want to get into a story that hasn't finished yet, maybe wait on it a little bit. But I don't know when it's going to end, if ever. But
I'm not caught up yet. So
no, me neither. I've just been buying the big omnibuses as they come out.
Yeah,
and they're only on the second one, so I'm a little ways behind. You might be ahead of me, actually. So
yeah, I think I have digital copies of a lot of the issues. You can find them all in digital. Different distribution methods.
Which is becoming increasingly popular in the world of comic books. I know a lot of people who that's how they read their comics now. It's all digital, which is great.
So, what do you have next?
Next, I have a book that I've never read cover to cover. It's like a reference book.
Okay.
And people who know me know that I love reference books. And I get really excited about them. This one is called The Penguin Book of Card Games. It sounds extremely boring, and you kind of know exactly what it is just by knowing what the title of it is. But probably more than any other book that I own, it's the book that I refer to the most. I've probably read certain passages of it like dozens of times, which is more than I can say about most of the other books that are in my collection, even the ones that I really love. So this book... It's the Penguin Book of Card Games, but it does actually have a single author. His name is David Parlett. He is a award-winning game designer and quite a noted card games expert. He consults for the Oxford English Dictionary with regards to gaming terminology, and he also does work for film and television production if... movies or TV wants to show their actors playing card games. He will teach the actors how to play the games, and he will work with the directors and the cinematographers on how to stage the game, and he'll make sure that the game that they're playing is period appropriate if it's a historical film, and that the cards look correct for the period in which the film or the being set. So he's kind of a cool, interesting guy. So the first edition of this book was published in 1979. It's been updated ever since. It's never gone out of print. The most recent edition, I want to say, was within the last 10 years. I don't know how many games are in this book, including variations. There's easily hundreds. The front of the book advertises 250 games, but it's definitely more than 250 games. What I love about it, though, is just how wide the scope of this book is. It includes rules for, like, essentially extinct games that were, like, centuries-old predecessors of modern games. It includes rules for games that are played by extremely small populations in, like, Europe and nowhere else.
So most of the games don't show the... A standard 52-card modern deck, there's a lot that gets outside that scope.
There's definitely some stuff that gets outside of that scope, and I think that's why I recommend this book to people, is because so many of us are used to playing with the 52-card, like, Anglo-American deck. And there's plenty of rules for games like that in this book, but there's also plenty of rules for... games that kind of exist outside of that format. He does limit himself to games that use decks of cards with four suits, because there are decks of cards out there in the world that have less or more than four suits. So he does limit himself in that way, but even within that range, there's such a a wide variety of deck designs and even like suit designs that you can play with. And there's going to be lots of like kind of unfamiliar rules that you've not seen in other games, or even familiar rules that you've seen in other games kind of combined and recombined in weird ways. And it's really interesting how wide the world of card games is. And the other thing I'll say about it is he actually writes with a lot of personality, so it's not just like a dry, here's how you play this game. He offers a little bit of history, he can be funny, he'll tell you if the game is good or if it's bad, because he'll just include some games for kind of like historical interest. He might offer you some strategy advice on certain games, especially if they're more complicated than others. Yeah, I highly recommend it, and it's a good excuse to go out and buy a unique deck of cards. I think most people probably have in a drawer somewhere, you know, the 54 if you've got jokers, deck of cards. But having a couple of cool decks to show off to people and teach them how to play games with is a lot of fun. I have a regular gaming group, and our regular games are actually played with a 78 card deck. And that's the deck that we've come to prefer, and the games that are played with it are the games that we've come to love the most. So that's nice. The deck that sees the most use. So I've foisted one of my weird decks of cards on you before, and it seemed to go okay. Yeah. So
was that like a German?
A Bavarian deck. Okay. Yeah, called the Schafkopf Tarok, and I don't speak German, so that could be. I could have just completely mangled it.
Yeah, it was definitely a different kind of game, different style of cards, but fascinating. Like, I didn't even realize a lot of this stuff existed before then. Well, we're doing pretty good on time, but before we go, I wanted to highlight some kind of interesting upcoming items. So, on the subject of comics, since I was talking about a comic not that long ago, this year, it was just announced that Vertigo was doing a big relaunch and rebranding for their 25th anniversary in business. So Vertigo is an imprint of DC Comics. It's where they would publish a lot of their more mature, more adult-themed comics.
I think Why the Last Man that we were just talking about might have been originally published under Vertigo.
Okay.
I think.
I know that, like, I think Sandman and, like, mm-hmm. Hellblazer. And
Watchmen.
Yeah, a lot of those items were all Vertigo mm-hmm. comics, and they have a great, like, great series. Like, I think Preacher was a Vertigo comic as yep. well, I believe.
I think so. I think Transmetropolitan was.
Yeah, so they have some good, good, very adult-oriented, pulpy, fun comics
sometimes,
in their history.
Sometimes deep and weird and yeah. experimental as well.
Exactly. Yeah. So they have still been, you know, so this relaunch isn't like a total relaunch. They have been continuing to publish all this time, but they're taking this 25th anniversary as a way to refocus their brand, and they're launching, I think, 7 or 8 new series starting this year mm-hmm. Into early next year. With all with a new diverse group of authors, women and people of color, and bringing in authors that may not have historically gotten a voice in the comic publishing yeah. world. So I know that that's something that I'm keeping an eye on.
Oh, me too. I love Vertigo, and to be honest, I thought they were gone because I hadn't heard anything from them in a long time. So I'm glad to hear they're still around, but I'm even more glad to hear that they've got a lot of new stuff coming out.
Yeah.
Hopefully one of them will be a future classic, just like a lot of the other stuff that's in their library. So
it looks like there's one called Border Town that's written by Eric Esquivel, who I guess is a writer on Adventure Time.
Oh.
And it looks like the general plot is when a crack in the border between worlds releases an army of monsters from Mexican folklore into the small town of Devil's Fork, Arizona. The residents blame the ensuing weirdness on illegal immigrants. That's the general plot
I like that. Yeah. That sounds good.
So that sounds kind of fun. Yeah. One written by Zoe Quinn, who's a video game developer.
Oh, sure.
It's called Goddess Mode. It's called In a Near Future, where all of humanity's needs are administered by a godlike AI, one young woman's horrible job to do tech support on it. So there's some interesting concepts for comics.
Yeah.
So there's a whole, like, seven or eight new comics that are being launched.
And what's cool about them is they all sound kind of funny, I think.
Yeah.
But they also all sound like they really pertain to very modern concerns, political and social, so...
Anything coming out soon that you're looking forward to?
There's all sorts of stuff coming out that I'm looking forward to. I'm definitely also looking forward to the Vertigo stuff. Speaking of comic books, Alan Moore has had this book that he's been talking about for 10 years that supposedly is going to get released any day now, supposedly called the Moon and Serpent Bumper Book of Magic. Apparently, now that he's finished his big, long novel that was like 1,000 pages long. I think that came out a couple years ago. It was called Jerusalem.
Okay.
And I have not read it.
I vaguely remember that, yeah.
He can finally buckle down and get to work on this thing, but it's been up for, like, pre-order for, like, literally 5 or 6 years and has yet to see the light of day. I feel like we talk about Alan Moore a lot for people who don't know who Alan Moore is. He's just a pretty influential guy in the world of comics. There's been a lot of movie adaptations of his work, like Watchmen and V for Vendetta.
League of Extraordinary Gentlemen,
From Hell. Most of them have unfortunately been really poor movie adaptations.
Yeah.
but nonetheless, he's definitely had a huge impact on pop culture. Probably the biggest is the Guy Fawkes masks that you see associated with a lot of protesters around the world. Granted, that was a conceit of the illustrator who did the book for him, but... Yeah, so he's got a book that might be coming out soon. And if it does come out soon, I'm buying it. I think it's supposed to be kind of like a tongue-in-cheek kind of collection of his thoughts on like creativity and magic and stuff like that. Stuff that he's really into and that's really weird but really fascinating. So,
yeah, he's always a fun read, even if he is kind of a crazy, cranky old man at this point. That kind of makes it fun.
Crazy, cranky old men sometimes write the best stuff. So, I'm definitely looking forward to that. That might be the big one for me, but unfortunately I don't know exactly when that's coming out.
Well, be on the lookout, yeah.
Yeah, the other thing that I'm kind of looking forward to is there's a publisher of art books called Taschen. I might be pronouncing that wrong. It's T-A-S-C-H-E-N. I think we have some of their books here in the library, like collected works of Gustav Klimt was produced by them. It's in our oversized book collection, and it's a really beautiful book. But they're releasing a complete works of Peter Bruegel, who was a big Flemish Renaissance artist that Joel will know. The cover of the Fleet Foxes debut album
had
one of his works on it.
Okay.
Like that super like maximalist landscape with just lots of like tiny little human beings running around and doing weird things.
Yeah.
That's very much his work. So getting all of his stuff together in one big, beautiful volume will be awesome. Can't wait for that.
Nice.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm looking forward to in the future. I'm sure there's plenty of other things, too. They're just kind of slipping my mind at the moment.
Well, yeah, there's always something on the horizon.
There is, yeah.
All right, well, that's probably about all the time we have today, but thanks for listening to our Summer Book Club Part 2.
Yeah, it's been fun. Maybe we'll do it again next year.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
All right, cool. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.